Hey everybody, welcome to episode 29 of The Good, Bad, and Wretched. My name is Chris, and with me is Josh.
Why are you just holding up your pinky?
Because I didn't want to flip you off.
Okay.
I'm used to flipping you off on the one when we do our countdown. And today we have a very special episode.
But shouldn't for I
you.
Have been the one flipping you off?
Maybe.
Okay.
Today we have a very special episode for you. This evening we attended the Vancouver Writers Fest, and we sat down with a horror author that you may know. His name is Craig Davidson, a.k.a. Nick Cutter. And we have a little bit of an interview coming up with him, so we're going to waylay all the what have you been watching and things like that and dive right into it.
Yeah, it's more like a lot of bit of an interview.
It's a what?
A lot of bit, not a little bit.
Oh, it's the whole damn thing. So anyway, enjoy.
Yep. Happy Halloween. Hey, everyone. We're at the Vancouver Writers Fest, and Chris and I are both very excited to be interviewing one of our favorite authors. With us tonight is Craig Davidson, a.k.a. Nick Cutter. Craig has been shortlisted for the Giller Award, and also as Nick Cutter, he's been a best-selling horror author. And we had some discussions before the before we started recording tonight, and this is going to be a really fun episode. So welcome, Craig, and thank you so much for doing this.
Well, thanks, Josh. Chris, it's lovely to be here.
So let's first talk about your new book.
Let's do so.
The Accolade.
Yes.
Published by Chaizine Press. And as we were talking about before, we think it's deserved that they get a little bit of some recognition right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, yeah, a lot, as much as we can heap upon them, and hopefully, other people follow onto the dog pile with that.
Because it's like I said to you, anytime I see that ZZP on the spine of the book, I know what I'm getting. I know I'm going to buy it, and I know I'm going to like it. And also, with the Accolade, perfect home for that.
Right.
Perfect home.
Yeah, I feel like it's in some ways the only home for that. And I feel like that CZP does a great job of, finding writers who fit their very specific mandate, you know. And there are certain writers who find a home with CZP who probably wouldn't find a home elsewhere. Or a book that they've written finds a specific home with them, and I'm grateful, obviously. I mean, I've been friends with Brett and Sandra, who are the founders and publishers and tireless advocates of CZP for years, and I knew when the Accolade, and previously I wrote Sarah Court, which was also by them. It's a wonderful experience to work with them, and you know they're working their ass off to get the books out and promote them. And as you said, once you become bitten by the CZP bug, it's really difficult to get that out of your bloodstream.
Yeah, and Sarah Court was actually their first title that I picked up.
Oh, was it? Okay. Yeah,
so you've got that going for you,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I appreciate that. That's
I was like,
lovely.
Oh, well, this is Sarah Court book all about. And then flip her over and see something about a guy going over the barrel in a barrel over Niagara Falls. I'm like, I'm in on this one. And then after that, it was anytime you see that name on the spine, like I said, coming home with me.
It is. It is. It's a marker of quality, and it's a marker of a certain aesthetic, I think, of fiction that you will not find, certainly not in Canada. And it's very, I think they're just discriminating in such a way that you know what you're going to get, although you don't. Because that's what the lovely part of it is, and the wonderful part is you don't actually know what you're getting with a CZP book until you open it up, but you know it's going to probably amaze you in some way that you've never been amazed before. And I speak not really of my own books, but I speak of the other books, Burgess, Tony Burgess, and Rio Yours, and Ian Rogers, and Michael Rowe, and Helen Marshall, and Dave Nichol. Many, many others, Bob Boychuk. So, yeah, they've got a really great stable of writers producing wonderful work.
And that's one of the great things about smaller presses, that they do have the freedom to be able to do things like that. And one thing I find really unfortunate about a lot of people that just read mainstream books is that they're missing out on so many things like this. So it's great that you can discover a press like this and trust that you're going to get quality work every time.
Yeah, very true. Very true. And I think it has to be a labor of love for Brett and Sandra and the writers who they work with, because because you recognize that because they don't necessarily always have the clout of, you know, because a big press can push out, like, as we all know, not terribly good books, maybe formulaic books, but they just have that reach and that scope and that span, is that you're going to get every place you walk into, Shoppers Drug Mart or wherever, oh, there's that book. And eventually maybe you cave and you pick it up. And quite honestly, there are plenty of readers who don't necessarily want to be challenged. You know, they have a hard day at work and they just want to go home and they want to read a couple chapters of a book that doesn't push them in some way or kind of task them with having any kind of, you know, higher reasoning in some level. And CZP books, I think, do ask something of you, but they also reward you fairly deeply, obviously, for that investment that you, extra investment that you give.
Great. So how about you tell us a bit about The Acolyte?
Sure. Yeah. It's my first crack at a dystopian book. I think, you know, almost all writers probably at some point just think, oh, I'm gonna give that a try. And the way it started for me, and I assume the way it started probably for a lot of writers, is you look around your world as it currently exists, and you see something that you know, terrifies you or worries you at the very least, and you think, well, what if that one aspect were nursed to its most almost farcical but hopefully still believable conclusion? And for me, that was you know, sort of the right-wing fundamental Christian belief system. And I thought, well, what if in some odd, terrible confluence of events, this became the operating theology and the way that, in fact, the operating way that the world works, you know? So it's basically a story about a world run by right-wing Christian values, and any religions or faiths that are not seen as adhering to the official state faith are heretical, and we need to sort of excise them and get rid of them. It basically deals with a small sect of, like, sort of off the police force, like a special task force called Acolytes, whose job it is to kind of seek out base faiths, eradicate them. And I was very influenced by Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451.
Great. It also sounds like maybe a bit of an influence from, like, the witch hunts from Salem.
Very true. Yeah, yeah. Or even the Hollywood witch hunts where that's right. Yeah, yeah. Where you know, scriptwriters and stuff, the Red Scare. So there is a basis in reality in terms of nothing that has gone quite that apocalyptic and crazy, but, you know, certain sentiments that within society, if they were allowed to get nursed to their sort of worst outcome, you know, do we have that possibility? As humankind, do we have that kind of that ability within us to go to that length? Yeah, I think we do, certainly. But I mean, I tried to make it in a way kind of, I think something I like about dystopias is that when you nurse something to its absolute point, it kind of gets farcical and weird. And so I certainly had fun actually writing the book. You know, as much as it was difficult at some levels, it was also a lot of fun to think of how ridiculous the world would be if you look at it through a certain lens.
And this book has had a long gestation period, I believe.
Yeah, yeah. Not to get too deeply into it, but it was back in the Bush years, actually, that I first wrote it. And I remember I watched an interview with Donald Rumsfeld, if we remember him, and this was during the Iraq war. And he, you know, told somebody on 60 Minutes, or I don't know where it was, that he actually went to church and he prayed to God for the answers of how he should dictate his policy for basically bombing Iraq. And I was flabbergasted, kind of, in a way. I thought, this person is admitting that I just wait for some divine sign about how I drop bombs on other people, and he has no sense that this might seem absurd. So yeah, and that's absurd, but it was also scary to me because this is, you know, the second or third most powerful human being in America who has his finger on the button, as they say. So yeah, that was kind of the motivating fear that informed the book.
Now, did you do, like, any rewriting on it before it came out recently? Because it's just kind of updated a little
bit. I did. It actually had a fair amount of, invective to be honest. A lot of proselytizing about how the, you know, yeah, just proselytizing about religion. And it was probably about twice as long as the book that now exists. So I just cut out a lot of stuff that didn't move the plot. You know, stuff that was just basically rhapsodizing about the evils of religion, and that didn't it just seemed to be me kind of just shouting into an echo chamber. So I really wanted to just distill it down to, here's the plot, here's the character. That should it should all kind of inform itself anyways. You understand kind of the underlying ethos of it without all this me explaining it to you. So it's really just stripped down to hopefully just a really quick thriller.
And how were you able to keep it scaled back from becoming farcical?
Well, that's a good question. I think, you know, depending reader by reader, they might say that I didn't exactly accomplish that task. But I tried to make it maybe, if not less farcical, less histrionic, less shrill. Because I think, as we were talking earlier, I find now my current outlook on it is a real hardcore atheist is kind of as annoying as a hardcore, you know, right-wing Christian. You know, an atheist kind of tries to say that if you believe in this, you're stupid. You're an idiot, and here are the reasons why. Whereas a Christian more or less says, you're going to hell. So neither of those are really arguable. Then they're kind of insulting each other. You know, it's one taking a position of you're an idiot, and the other taking the position of you're going to burn in the eternal pit of fire. So there's no argument to be had there. And I think I don't like to exist on those sort of borderlines anymore or the fringes. So I tried to scale it back so that there was more just, yeah, a propulsive thriller. And hopefully I've accomplished that, yeah.
Yeah, it's totally different from the other Cutter books.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, it's less straight horror. Yeah, I think there's horrifying aspects of it, but I didn't write it as a horror book per se. I wrote it more as a dystopian thriller.
And certainly with you saying that it had been written back in the Bush era, it puts to rest my question as, how the hell is he getting two books out in one year?
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Well, one of the interesting things about having, you know, having a book, say, even like Cataract City, which, I mean, it's not like it blew anybody's doors off in terms of, like, selling a whole bunch of copies but suddenly you can go to publishers with work that you're fond of and proud of and think has meaning. And publishers will look at it in a different light. That wasn't the case with The Acolyte, because Cheezian and I have always been on good terms, so that wasn't it. But yeah, there will be a couple books coming out over the next couple years, and I'm very proud of them. And they've had a long gestation period, so I'm glad that they can actually come to light now. And I think, you know, if you look at a lot of writers' careers, you might find that. Is that you have some success, and then books that you've worked on before, you know, are literally the same editor can be like, oh, what, like, what's this? I'm like, well, you read it 2 years ago. Oh, no, I didn't. No, it had to be a different book. I'm like, no, okay, if you want to believe that, that's perfectly all right. So yeah, it's nice. It's nice then. So if it feels like I'm being especially prolific lately, it's not necessarily that. Although I am prolific, it's more that some of these books that I've felt a lot of fealty and love for and want to kind of re-emerge with are you know, finding favor.
So can we talk a little bit about these new books?
Sure.
Can we
we
have a little rundown of what we can expect?
Sure. Yeah. So the unholy duo of Nick Cutter and Craig Davidson have three books coming out. So the first of which will be Precious Cargo, which is a book memoir, basically, of a year that I drove a special needs bus and my experience and what I learned, I guess, not to be too cliche or tacky about it, and the kids that I met and just how that affected me. And it's obviously a book very close to my heart. And then after that, a couple months after that, actually, I think in June, will be Little Heaven, which is the new Nick Cutter book. which is a big slobber knocker of a book. It'll be, I think it'll be my biggest book ever. You know, probably 500 pages. Which in which like three mercenaries are tasked with going to a remote encampment to rescue the nephew of the woman who has hired them.
Okay.
And you know, they think it's going to be an easy kind of gig, and this just go get this little whippersnapper, and then we'll get back to civilization. That doesn't exactly work out that way. So there are impediments to that, to a happy resolution. And then a short story collection.
Okay.
Will be the last one.
And will the short story collection be under Nick Cutter or Craig
Davis? No, sorry. It won't be horror. It'll be, you know, whatever. A Craig Davidson book.
Great.
Yeah, yeah.
So kind of a throwback to Rust and Bone, maybe?
Yeah, yeah. It'll be my first collection of fiction. Cerecourt was in some ways kind of a collected vignettes.
Yeah, very loosely.
Yeah, very loosely, yeah. But this will be my first real short story collection since then, although it's got a very big novella in it, like about 60,000 words. So it'll be sort of dominated by this major short novel.
Great. Now, Rust and Bone was your first book as Craig Davidson.
That was it, yeah.
So one question I had about it, I mean, the subject matter as Craig Davidson is not that far off from Nick Cutter.
You are correct.
As far as a tone goes.
Yeah.
But a question I had about the book is Rocket Ride and Rust and Bone were adapted into the film Rust and Bone, mm-hmm. directed by Jacques Audiard and starring Marianne Cotillard. Who won a number of awards for that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering, how was the process of having your work transformed into a screenplay and a film? How was it like letting go of your work, and how involved were you?
Oh, yeah, okay. Well, that's a great question. Well, how involved was I? Like, zero. Jacques Audiard is... And his new film, actually, I ran into Patrick DeWitt, author of the Sisters Brothers, a couple of days ago in Calgary, and that is going to be his next film. Jacques Audiard will be doing the Sisters Brothers in English, so it'll be his first English film.
Great.
And, yeah, we sort of went back and forth, you know, our own separate experiences with Mr. Audiard, and it sounds like similar. You know, ultimately, Jacques is... I know he's in his 60s now. He's been doing this for a long time. He started out as a screenplay writer. So, I mean, he has his own way of doing things. And I think with Rust and Bone, he, as far as I'm concerned, found the parts that were applicable to him and sort of resonated with him. And he took those parts and used those parts and adapted those parts. And then he built around it a frame which was completely his own. A love story... and a certain wisdom. Like, I wrote Rust and Bone primarily when I was, I would say, between the ages of 25 and 28. So it was like an angry young man book. And I was dealing with the emotions that I felt at that time, which were of a single man and a young man, basically. And he instilled in it, in the movie, as I said, like a wisdom and a maturity that does not exist anywhere in that book. You know, I didn't have that. I didn't have that emotional kind of understanding of the world. But he also kept, I think, the power of youth, you know, and that kind of forcefulness. And so he used that to his benefit, and then he buttressed it and kind of fleshed it out with his own kind of wonderful worldliness and maturity. So it's like really the perfect synthesis that I could think of, you know, between what he took from my book and what he added on his own. And it's its own thing. You know, the book is its own thing, and I'm very proud of that book. And the movie is his own thing, and I'm proud to have been associated with it.
Yeah, I mean, he like did things, even changing the sex of the lead character.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I remember like I think it was my agent called me up and said, you know, they're changing the sex of the character. It's going to be, I know it was a man. It's going to be a woman. I said, well, okay. I think they were thinking I was going to be outraged. Not that I had any choice in the matter. Right. Anyway, I could have been outraged. I wasn't. But then he said, oh, and it's going to be Marion Cotillard. I said, oh, that's good. You know, I can't really find anything to argue about at this point. So, and she, obviously she did a wonderful job. And it's, you know, now, honestly, when I think of that story, I can't help thinking that Marion's in it. You know, even if I were to reread the story right now, I'd probably more picture Marion in that role in my head than I would the actual male character that I'd written.
Wow.
Yeah.
But that's got to feel good, having something that you've written be giving this new life by somebody else and interpreting in that way. And that's got to be like feeling like your first real feeling of accomplishment, like, because you said you're an angry young man, mm-hmm. and you were writing these stories. And I bet when you were writing these stories, you never thought that someone was going to make a film out of these, right? And that's just got to give you that feeling, right?
Oh, you're right. I mean, blue skying it, I suppose you always hope for that, right? But no, I think once you've been writing for a couple of years too, you recognize that it's all very fragile and fleeting, and any kind of good fortune you have along that line is good fortune that you've been gifted by some sort of external force that you don't have any power over, and good fortune that could have gone to anybody else except for yourself. So yeah, I was and really it does, you can actually. Because when the book first came out, like there were, I remember the first big American review, my editor at the time called me up and said, we've got, it's going to be in the New York Times. You're going to have a review in the New York Times. And we've heard about it. We don't know what it is. You know, we don't know the context of it. But, and so it was Christmas Day. And I was back home celebrating at my parents' house. So I get up in the morning and go down to their computer and, you know, bring it up on Christmas Day before anyone's up, and it's just a slam. It's just
Merry Christmas.
It's just the most brutal, kind of that, like, it's a juvenile book, and it's all about machismo, and there's, you know what I mean? He's, like, obsessed with masculinity. You know, you sort of trudge upstairs just like, oh, God, how am I going to, you know, hey, whatever. You do get over it. But I thought my career is going to be over. You know, I thought this review is just going to submarine me. So you carry that around with you. You carry that sense of like, well, maybe it is all these things that this person said. Because sometimes you operate in this very small bubble of of criticism, really, of self-criticism, of you know. So when someone like Jacques Audiard picks it up, and when someone like Marion Cotillard or Matthias Schoenaerts or agree to be part of it, it feels good. It feels validating. It feels like, oh God, okay, like these are very creative, talented people, and they find some value in it and something that they can work with and something that you know, they can bring to a different space. So it's great. And I just ride that wave. You know what I mean? You take that and it can rehabilitate a book in a weird way, actually. Like, people now look at that book differently in light of the movie than they did when it was just the book.
Well, it's like they always say, you're your own worst critic anyway, right?
To
use a cliche.
Yeah, sure, sure.
But speaking of critics, I was just wondering, like, how do things like Amazon reviews affect you?
Like, they shouldn't.
yeah. Well,
I was just wondering, because I mean, and there are out there, and you know, there's things from one end of the spectrum to the other.
Sure.
But people, you know, obviously many of them don't know what they're talking about. But I was just curious, how do you read those? Do you care?
Well, I used to. No, I don't now. More as a, you know, it's tough to get through your day sometimes when you get a bad review. And it doesn't matter where it comes from. You think it would matter more if it were in the New York Times or something that you assume a lot of people are going to see. But in terms of your own sense as a writer, a creative type, you know, a real scathing review in an Amazon or a Goodreads review can torpedo your day. So I don't do it because every day I need to write. You know, that's my career, that's my job. I can't really afford to take a day off. And I certainly can't. I mean, I can take afford. I have to take a day off if my son gets sick or, you know, the exigencies of life that come up that force you to miss a day. But you can't miss it for like a hangover. You can't miss it for a bad review. And so I just I forced myself long ago that I just do not read Goodreads reviews. I don't read Amazon reviews. And you know, back if I were writing in the 50s, any book, even some of the biggest books, you would probably have to face maximum 15 reviews. You know, the big papers would put out the reviews, and that's only if your editor cut it out, put it in an envelope, and sent it to you. Now, he or she would have to be a real turd to send you the bad ones, but okay, let's say they did that. So you weather those 15, good or bad, and then you're on to your next book. Nowadays, as you know, there is an illimitable number of reviews and people who can comment on your work and like it or dislike it. So if you have a tolerance and a thick skin, and I do have a thick skin, but if it's thick enough that you can read your own reviews and just say, ah, screw it, and get back to your own work, then fine. I can't. So I just need to, like, ignore them and work on my stuff.
Probably for the best.
Yeah, there's probably not, you're probably not getting a lot out of it, right?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. So,
but on Rust and Bone, you certainly got a lot of accolades from accolades.
Why don't you do accolades?
From some big heavy hitters. I mean, I think that's the one Clive Barker first mentioned.
Yep.
And Peter Straub and Bret Easton Ellis. I mean, these are big names. And obviously, just from your writing style and just from what we've talked about, probably big influences as well.
Huge. Yeah. I think that's one of the biggest, you know, people ask, what is the biggest joy you get out of writing? And it, I guess it changes day by day. And but one of the biggest things is certainly when I was a starting writer, or even the first Cutter book, is the idea that Stephen King had actually read my book was just like mind blowing. And then he had something nice to say about it. Same thing, or Chuck Palahniuk, or as you said, Bret Easton Ellis, or Peter Straub, or Clive Barker. You know, that to me is just. That was just amazing, because I like, yeah, that's why you get into it, I guess. You know, I mean, I didn't think of that at the time, but the people that you really idolize, really, really idolize, you know, I idolize my parents and I idolize other people, but creatively and sort of career wise, these are my biggest influence. This is the people that, like, when I was 13 years old, I was huddled under the covers reading these on rainy days or sunny days or whenever, and that. You know, at some future date, they would get work of mine and read it and then have something nice to say about it is not just validating. It's just kind of euphoric, actually. So it's wonderful. Yeah, it's been very fortunate. They've been very generous.
It does have to be pretty mind-blowing to have a guy like Stephen King calling your books like old school horror at its best.
Yeah. Well, and Stephen King, as you guys know, as you know, as horror lovers yourself, he's very... he's effusive, and he's a huge boon to the genre. Like, he really, you know, some writers do a couple blurbs and then you never hear from them again. They're just like, I'm tired. I don't want to blurb every book that comes in. I don't necessarily want to contribute back to my genre that helped make me, which is fine. There's no, you know, there's plenty of writers that I like a lot that don't blurb very much. But Stephen King continues to stay abreast of the genre, continues to be really supportive of writers. And, you know, his blurb carries weight.
Well, and his blurb also single-handedly gave Clive Barker a career in North America.
That was like one of the most prophetic and amazing. Yeah, the future of horror. Yeah. His name is Clive Barker.
I remember being 12 years old, seeing that quote, being like, "Okay, I got to go buy these freaking books of blood right now."
Yeah, yeah, and you know, and they measured up too. Mm-hmm. You know, they were. You know, Stephen King wasn't blowing smoke on that. I mean, Clive Barker did end up being the heir apparent in some. Not that. That's tough, because you can never really... Stephen King is the alpha and omega, and Clive Barker is excellent. I love Clive Barker. There's never going to be another Stephen King.
Well, no,
There's never going to be another Clive Barker. I mean, what he does is absolutely authentic and beautiful and perfect in its own way.
Well, Stephen King's the guy who brought this genre that we love to the forefront of mainstream.
Yeah. Especially in the writing side of it, you know, in sort of the filmic side of it, there's all sorts of different people who could be credited with that. But yeah, definitely Stephen. I mean, he brought in a whole bunch of crap too, you know. I mean, that's everyone's trying to get through the door that he opened, basically. But there were a ton of great writers that came through with like Peter Straub, although he writes a different kind of horror, a more, I think, quiet and controlled style of horror. But, you know, it was no less a titan of horror as well.
So how does the story go about that? Like, when you got that pull quote,
yes,
do you remember the exact moment of
that? Oh, like, utterly. Well, first of all, I didn't even know. It wasn't something that my editor said, we're going to send this book to Mr. King and see if we can get lucky. What it was, and you guys would know this because you're students of the genre, there is a small press called Cemetery Dance.
Yep.
Run by Rich Chismar, who is a good friend and ally of Stephen. And he got an arc of the troupe and read it and enjoyed it. And he must have thought, oh, you know who would like this? Stephen. So he sent it of his own volition to King. And King sat down at some point. I guess he trusts Chismar's, kind of taste. And sat down and read it. And then I was sitting on a couch one day with my laptop on my stomach. And bing. And you look, and it was from my editor. And, oh, we got a quote. And he was kind of couch, you know, he was kind of being like, we just got a quote, kind of like,
no big deal, whatever.
Yeah, exactly, yeah, you know, you're
just okay. Some dude.
Yeah, just some dude. And then you read it, and I just looked over at my wife like, you know, you really are speechless. You're speechless in a way, and Stephen King more than anybody. I mean, I've been grateful of any of the writers who have said lovely things about me, and but there's something about King. I mean, King was just the writer that, the rainy day... anywhere you were, I mean, I would have a Stephen King book stapled to my backpack, basically. I'd always have one on the go. Yeah. So it meant more to me. It meant a lot to me. Let's say that.
Well,
I don't think we've mentioned the quote yet.
I did mention
the
quote.
Okay.
did you forget? Hear... What's the one you have?
No, the troop scared the hell out of me.
Oh, I didn't mention that, no.
That's okay, yeah, no worries.
No, I just said old school horror at its best. Yeah. And I do agree with him. So.
Yeah, I think it's a good assessment, for sure.
So why don't we talk about the troop a bit?
Sure.
Now, this is the first thing I want to say before we dive into troop is that for your pseudonym... worst kept secret in Canadian literacy. I had already been reading your regular books.
Yes, okay.
And then all of a sudden I heard, oh, there's this book coming out called The Troop. It's by this guy Nick Cutter. And then I was like, who the hell's Nick Cutter?
Right.
Go online, it's like, oh, Craig Davison's Nick Cutter. Like, this is like the worst thing. At least with Richard Bachman when it was King, kind of
took a while. Yeah.
So, like, was that on purpose?
Yeah, it really was, actually. I mean, the idea of Nick Cutter was not my idea. It was my agent's idea, but it was my agent working under the assumption of readership, what people want to read, and what this person wrote this book and then he wrote this book. That's like, I can't even fit that into my head.
Well, yeah,
and that's not actually, that's not the way he thinks exactly, but that's the way publishers think, and that's the way publishers assume that people think. And I disagree with that. I don't share that sentiment. I certainly have read writers who work on different sides of the street, and it seems pretty vital and natural to me that that would be the case. And also, because we did talk about Cheezine, and I would never want people like Cheezine to think that I made up this silly pseudonym so that I could distance myself from genre, because as we just spoke about, I'm a child of a genre, and those are the books that I grew up loving, and those are the books I love to this day. So the worst feeling would be that someone would come away with the impression that I don't care enough about these books to use my own name.
Yeah.
So even though the pseudonym exists, I've gone to great lengths, including in this interview, to make sure it's it's known that I am Craig Davidson, and Craig Davidson is Nick Cutter.
Well, I can see where they're coming from on that, in the sense that, you go from Cataract City, mm-hmm. very literary, very kind of like, more of a human story.
Mm-hmm.
Into a book where basically an evil tapeworm is killing Boy Scouts.
Right.
So I can see where maybe they were like, okay, maybe we need
to separate the camps a little bit
somehow, because the people who are reading Cataract City aren't exactly going to be like reading this troop book and being like, they'd probably be looking at you like you lost your mind, right?
Right, right.
But what's the story behind the pseudonym? I remember sort of hearing about how it came to be.
Oh, the actual like nuts and bolts of
yeah.
it. Yeah, well, I mean, that was probably the most fun part of the whole process is that it's another thing where you're trying to guess what people want. You know, what do people want in a name even? How do they want their horror writer to present him or herself, even though you're just making it up? So,
mm-hmm.
So Nick, you know, my son's name is Nicholas. Nick, I mean, I assume when he gets older, we'll just call him Nick, and we do right now. So it's kind of an honorific to the little squirt, whether he's going to grow up to feel like, oh, that's cool, Dad. Thanks a lot. who knows? And then you know, my agent was like, you know, we got King, we got Barker, we've got it's all very declarative, punchy kind of names. You know, so it's like Butcher, Slasher, you know, Box. But there's already CJ Box. There's already a writer who has Box. You know, so we just threw in there, and it almost got ridiculous and silly. But I guess in my own head, since I knew I was going to eventually just like blow the lid on it anyways, I thought the sort of the more nuttier pseudonym we came up with, the more fun it'll be when it you know, becomes clear that it actually is a pseudonym. So yeah, Cutter is what we settled on because it sounded really, it sounded appropriate for the material. Yeah.
I'm glad it wasn't something like you looked over and saw a paper cutter.
Yeah.
It really could have been, you know, you say that, you know, jokingly, but it really could have been something as absurd. I don't know how other people, I think Stephen King came up with Richard Bachman because he was listening to Bachman Turd or Overdrive or something, and that's where it came from. You know, so there's always probably some really silly story that backgrounds almost any kind of – like I don't know how Rowling came up with Robert Galbraith.
Yeah.
But I bet you if she ever tells the world, it's probably going to be some goofy.
Same thing could be said for like Jack Ketchum.
Yeah,
guys like
exactly.
That, you know,
yeah.
Like how did he come up with the Jack Ketchum name?
So his own name, though, is so Dallas Mayer.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the funniest name on its own.
But his,
you know?
his real name sounds like he should be writing like serial westerns.
Yeah, that's
so
right. Yeah.
You're just kind of like, well, maybe it's a good thing you went with the Ketchum name.
Yeah, no, exactly.
There.
Yeah.
So were you a scout?
Yes. Yeah, I was a terrible scout. if you put me in the woods for about a 3 minutes, I'd probably be dead. Well, but yes, I was.
You put them on an island for like a weekend and they're
oh,
dead anyway,
I'm definitely
right?
gone. Yeah.
So so my first impression of the troop reading it was, I was like, okay, this perfectly could be made into a movie,
mm-hmm.
obviously, right? And I just thought it was like a monster movie, kind of a gross out kind of a romp.
Yeah, and yeah.
I'm assuming that's the tone you were kind of going for
totally.
With that. Because you've said, you know, you're a big guy with the genre, like mm-hmm. film, books, and stuff like that. And I'm going to say, if this is like a calling card where you're like, okay, this is my calling card. I'm in the horror genre. What do you think?
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, that's pretty gross. I think I'm on board with this,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
So was it your scouting non-experience, I guess you'd call
right.
it, that made you want to kill Boy Scouts? Like, what pops in your head? You're like,
a lot of
you know
bad
what?
Experiences
you know
there.
I think I want to kill
myself.
Some Boy
yeah.
Scouts. So I just want this evil tapeworm to jump out and kill some people.
Hey, you know, no, it was more, you know, Cataract City, the first part of Cataract City dealt with two boys lost in the woods.
Yeah.
And then it goes on to follow them sort of through adulthood or early adulthood. And what I recognize looking back at that experience of writing that book is I really enjoyed writing about childhood. You know, it actually is really fun. And, you know, they talk about writing being therapy in some ways. And the enjoyment sometimes comes from going back to those points in your life and trying to remember how you lived then. Because it's very difficult as an adult to kind of focus your mind on how you thought as a kid and how your friends might have thought as kids. But it's fun to try.
Yeah.
So afterwards, I came up with this idea of, as you said, like a very clearly horror idea that I would not be able to run by the boards as a literary novel. But the main drawing point was that I would like to write about these kids, you know, as we've sort of discussed around, and not to give spoilers, and I probably won't right now, but, you know, there's the isolation, it's these boys on an island. and there's a threat. But my main drawing to it was to get to write about kids again, and the rights of boyhood, and the rights of how boys interact with each other, and especially when you put kids in a situation where they have to grow up really fast, they have to mature in some way and take on responsibilities that they could have easily abandoned, you know, or would never in normal run of their lives would ever have had to embrace. And that was the part of Cataract City too, is these two boys lost in the woods, they had to grow up really fast. And these boys in the troop also had to grow up really fast. So that compressed growth period was something that really was interesting to me.
Well, and a lot of the group dynamics of kids are captured very well in that book. And I was a cub myself, and I could certainly see a lot of the personalities that I knew when I was a cub, or I didn't make it to Scouts.
But, right.
But still, that age group and just the different personalities, and you were able to capture them right away and give them all distinct personalities that were, you know, able to work off each other.
Yeah, well, thank you. I appreciate that. And I mean, also in the horror... In horror books, too, you can get away a little – getaways might not be the right word, but you know, you can have types almost. You know, you have the jock, you have the nerd, you have the studious type, you have the kind of closet psychopath. You know, you can have – and I think there's a certain understanding of how they'll work off each other. And you know, horror is a very moral genre in that if you do wrong – the feeling is you're going to pay for that at some level. Yep. You know, if you step, I mean, the classic is in Friday the 13th, you know, the two sneak away to have sex because they've transgressed in that way. They're going to get a machete through their bellies. You know, that's just, well, that's the, you've stepped over the line. You've, you know, had premarital sex or whatever. You know, it was fun to play with that too, of the notion that if you have a moral failing, even as a child, you'll have to pay the piper for that kind of behavior, basically. And I think horror readers come to expect that to a certain end. It's sort of like there's a warm blanket feeling of like, okay, that person met his end in a way that felt fair.
Yeah, or you're just waiting for it to happen.
Yeah,
you're
like, that's right. That's
don't
right.
Friggin' time. Yeah. So why don't we talk a little bit about the follow-up then?
Mm-hmm.
We'll talk about The Deep now,
mm-hmm.
because this book for me is the ultimate cutter book.
Right, okay.
The reason for that is this is definitely, I don't want to sound like a fanboy to you right now,
right.
But this is my favorite horror book of the year.
Oh, good. Okay? Thank you.
So the reason is this is, for me personally, you know, everyone has their own specific fears that works for them. And for me, it's that isolation, that claustrophobia. And, you know, you can't get much more isolated than being thrown at the bottom of the Mariana Trench, right? And what you've also done in this is you've thrown in a lot of psychosis and you've thrown in a lot of that guilt from the main character, you know, losing his child and that. And I have a feeling this book was kind of written around the same time that you were having your first child and that kind of affected where the story went in the end. Am I wrong on that?
No, it's very astute, Chris. Yeah, that's very, very much the case. I, my son Nick was about a year when we were, when I was writing it. And, you know, when your child is that young, they're beset by all sorts of illnesses that, you know, like a flu or a cough or something, you know, suddenly you're up in the middle of the night and you're sitting with your wife or your husband and you're asking yourself, did we take him into the emergency room? They can't express their pain and such. And so you do. You end up having a lot of emergency room visits where they just say, Tylenol, Advil, go home. You know, but it throws out your routine. It sharpens your fear about everything because you're just not sure. And you think, oh, this little tiny creature could be taken away from you in the most innocuous and mundane of ways. And so that definitely, you know, I think when I first started writing this book, I'm not really an outliner. So Luke, the main character, I wasn't sure what his main guilt was going to be when I started writing the book, but it sort of wrote itself by my own existence at that time. And I thought, well, you know, what would I feel most guilt over? And most guilt would be if I somehow was responsible for my son getting hurt or lost or something. And so, you know, the scenes that deal with that in the book are – were difficult to write. And you know, someone came up to me in Calgary and said, because there's a lot of creepy scenes, I hope, in the book.
Oh, yeah.
But the one that she was most upset her as a young mother was the scene where Luke's son just goes missing in a park.
Right.
You know? And that's the one that she felt, from her experience, affected her the most.
Well, yeah, because it was kind of like you had that aesthetic in there of the lost child, which kind of affected the rest of that character's life up to that point. Because, mm-hmm. you know, I don't know what the time frame was. I can't quite remember, but it happened quite a while ago.
Yeah,
and then
yeah.
he had been living with that guilt for a while. And then when you isolate a character who's living with that guilt and you're throwing in all this psychotic, like, you know, whisperings coming from the, you know, you basically have the guy trying to escape through air ducts like an alien. You know, you got this creature
right.
kind of like that movie Leviathan chasing yeah. him. You know, it just adds that extra texture to it, where it could have been just your standard monster movie book, mm-hmm. but because you put that extra texture on there with the guilt and of, you know, being a father and failing at being a father,
mm-hmm.
I thought that really said something and made that book rise above something you could standardly pick up, like you said, at the, you know, the pharmacy in the
right,
top
right.
10 paperbacks or something like that.
Oh, good. Well, I'm glad you thought so. I mean, obviously, opinions vary vastly. So
especially on Amazon.
Yeah. It's very difficult to, you know, but that's another thing. If you're going to try and please all readers, that you're going to get yourself in trouble
yeah.
pretty quickly. If you set off with a mandate of, I'm going to try and write a book and I'm going to try and make everybody happy and kind of satisfy everybody's needs and wants. I don't know what the book would end up being. I can't even really wrap my head around how you would go about doing that. But there is a certain point where if you alienate, you have to hope if you alienate this reader, then you are doing something that makes this reader
yeah.
Pleased, you know? So, and I'd like to write a book that, you know, maybe it's something that you refine yourself as you go forward. You know, I still consider myself, I'm not young, but I consider myself a fairly young writer, and I'm still learning things and I'm still trying to get better, and I'm still, and hopefully with the forbearance of a readership and my publishers, I'm going to have more chances to kind of like just work towards the kind of books that are closer to exactly what I want, you know, but at
right.
the same point, I realize I'll probably die before I ever actually reach that point, because it's like chasing a heat shimmer on the highway. You're never really going to catch it, you know, but as long as it exists as a motivation, it's good enough, you know,
right.
It's not like, cause if you ever think, oh, I've done good enough. You know, I can't imagine myself ever thinking that, you know, there'll always be something I want to make better or change or do differently. And so if I ever do go read an Amazon review at some time, it will probably be just to remind myself, oh yeah, I've got, you know, in certain people's eyes, I've got some work to do.
Well, if you ever got to the point where you're like, oh, that's good enough, I don't think you should be a writer.
Yeah, I have to find something else to do. Exactly.
You should maybe go work down at the 7-Eleven or something. But that's good enough.
Right.
That's
yeah, exactly. I'll just sell Big Bites.
So we were at a panel earlier tonight,
yes.
and one of the questions that came up in the panel was there any lines that you wouldn't cross?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know about you, but I was pretty excited when you were like, nope.
Yeah.
Well, the thing is you had also said, you know, being a genre reader
mm-hmm.
and seeking out those extremes.
Yeah, yeah.
I can tell you, too, I've done the same thing. I know you haven't stepped on the lines that some people have done,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, right. Like,
I think maybe just to mainstream audiences, maybe you've stepped on these lines
yeah.
a bit more, like grind
yeah.
them underfoot. Like we were talking, you know, I said to you earlier, I was like, oh, The Troop, perfect movie. But then you're like, but we kill kids. And I was like,
yeah
you got a point
yeah,
there, right?
Yeah. Well, so, and animals come to grim ends as well. So
yeah.
there's...
Yeah, that was a horrific part of that.
Right, right. Yeah.
Not to mind Cannibal Holocaust, yeah. that's all we'll say.
And then you
well,
were
you
done.
Well, you guys having done that, you know, I know a large part of your... a show is movies and off the beaten track movies that
yeah.
you know, once you've explored those domains of excess or extremism, you know, and those are domains that are fun to go to. I you know, honestly, I don't think I could go. Like, a guy that I loved growing up was Ed Lee, you know, who was just the most like extreme out there sadist, right? And he, you know, he's a very intelligent writer, a good guy. He's almost got trapped by being this like excessive Goremeister kind of writer, and that's lovely in a way, but also like there's no way he gets published outside of the small press, really, because it's just there's major presses. No, there's just not there's not that much of an appetite. Like us three in some ways are anomalies. Yeah. You know, we're able to go over the line and read Stephen King or watch, you know, Insidious or you know, the movies that also, you know, mainstream audiences will accept. But I also like to step on the other side of that line as far down as I can. And, you know, it used to be one of the things when I was a teenager was go to the video store, not Blockbuster because they didn't necessarily have some of these, but we had like some bigger video stores in our cities that whoever was ordering videos got some really interesting stuff. And now, of course, the internet allows you just to get it on your own. But it would be great. You'd rent like three movies and they were just like shaky, terrible footage, looked like it had been made for like $1,000. And it really looked like it had been made by like escape mental patients, you know, but it was great. You know, I was so happy to kind of have that opportunity to see those. But once you've seen those, anything that I've ever written, I know, and you guys know, yes, it's maybe transgressive, it maybe crosses some lines. But since the line for me has been blown so far out by what I've seen and read, I know I'm not touching the line that I know really exists.
Well, yeah, like those people who are going to watch Insidious, they're not exactly going to go home and watch Martyrs the next day or something
exactly.
like that, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah, exactly.
So, I mean,
or Cannibal Ferox or, you know, Ilsa She-Devil of the SS or any of those, yeah.
So I think, yeah, that does kind of, you know, talk about your work in the sense that it is kind of a niche in a way because there are guys like us who are willing to step over that line with you, no problem, right? And it's good that you have that, you know, courage to do that, especially considering that you are published by a fairly big publishing house and that they're actually willing to go with
that. Yeah, I mean, to me, it's like if they're willing to go there, you know, but as I go on, I think as you get older, you probably would see this in some directors too, probably any creative endeavor. Yeah. As you get older, you just...
Tone it down.
Yeah. And you don't tone it down. And it's more like, well, I've already gone... I've already done that.
Doesn't feel as forbidden.
Right, yeah, you exactly. And some people just stop making films because maybe they've said what they wanted to say and they've said it in the most extreme manner possible. And then, but if they stick around for a while, there is a softening usually. And I know my next book is, although it's pretty, you know, it's not like anyone's going to think it's not a Nick Cutter book, but I think the one after it, the way I'm thinking about writing it, which I haven't set pen to paper on it, but it's going to be more, there is. There'll be a, softening is probably not the exact word I'm looking for, but
tone down.
yeah and it can still be scary because I mean as they were talking about at the panel today, you don't always need to gross people out.
No.
To and if I have a failing, and I do, it's probably that I don't have to show everything, you know, but the books that I've written so far, it feels vital to actually, it seems part of the DNA of the book to show. But if you actually engineer a book with a different kind of DNA where you're much more kind of telling and not showing, then sort of invoking more so, you know, kind of pointing towards horrors but not actually showing them, it can be absolutely scary. And we've all read books or seen movies that do that really well. So it's another kind of opportunity to try something different.
I feel like you might have reached your gross out point with The Troop, though.
Yeah, I might be coming down from that. You're right. Yeah,
I'm still amazed
that at some level I'm still amazed it was published, you know, by a major publisher. Anyways, so yeah.
So, like, when writing The Troop or anything for that matter, have you ever written anything so disturbing that you changed it? That you felt was so disturbing that you reeled
it
back?
I haven't. I have been compelled to do so by editors who I trust. And in that case, like, I've never willingly stepped back from a line that I have mapped. But I have been, yes, convinced to by... And, you know, that's a hard lesson to learn. When I was young, I had written some books and I didn't take that advice, much to my peril, as I discovered. And as I think I said earlier, writing now is a collaborative thing with me. I trust my editors. I want to make sure that it's not just my voice entirely. It is my voice filtered through their opinions and the way that they think the work would maybe more properly kind of hit its mark. So yeah, I have not ever done it myself, but I have been convinced to do so, and I think it's probably been for the best.
Now, you mentioned earlier that one of your favorite authors, or one author that you really admired, was Edward Lee.
Yes, yeah.
And from what I understand, one of the first published book that you had was a split novella with Edward Lee.
Yeah, way back when, yeah.
How was that? Like, was that... That must have been a pretty exciting...
Yeah, totally.
...moment for you.
Yeah, very much so. It's... My first books were under a pseudonym, and they were published by a press called Necro in in Florida, the home of hardcore horror, and by Dave Barnett, who is the kind of the one-man dynamo down there. And again, I owe so much to Dave, and we obviously still keep in touch, and I would love to do work for him in the future if at all possible. But he and Ed Lee have a very... close relationship, and Necro is kind of the official small press publisher of Ed Lee. And so I had a story and Ed had a story, and they thought, well, why don't we just put them together in a book? And I kind of wrote Ed's coattails in that case. So I was very, I was probably 25 or 26 at that point. So I was deeply grateful to be able to write his coattails.
That must have been super exciting. And what I've read that Nick Cutter is kind of putting to rest your previous pseudonym.
Yeah, that's right.
It's the new improved version.
Yeah, it's sort of like one had to die so that Nick could live.
It's easier to pronounce.
Yeah, that's right. That's absolutely right. And I suppose Nick at some point might go the way of the dodo bird as well, depending. I'm gonna obviously ride the Nick Cutter Express for as long as I possibly can, and who knows, maybe it'll, at the moment, Nick Cutter is it's weird to have your pseudonym outstrip your own your own name. It's kind of weird to have that, like, who does better, and right now, Nick Cutter is kind of doing better, but I have no problem of doing it. People have asked me that before, do you feel like does it feel weird to have a pseudonym that is doing better than your own name? And I'm like, well, not because I don't see it that way.
No.
Obviously, I see it as the same. I see it as the same person. I just see I'm putting out books under two different names. But I do find too, genre audiences are really loyal.
Yeah.
Whereas if you write a literary book and that literary book gets nominated for prizes or wins it a big prize, you can expect a sales spike, and you can expect that particular book to maybe be very well feated and sell really well. But if you come up with another book and it doesn't get those nominations or whatever, audiences are kind of fickle. They're more like, well, I'm going to go to this book that has gotten all that kind of hubbub this year, and that's the book they're going to buy.
So I read in one of your articles that's posted on your website, you talk about running into a sort of a literary snob at a party.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering, what would that literary snob think of Nick Cutter?
Yeah, I ran into that literary snob like a year ago. She'd read the article.
The actual one?
And she knew it was her. Again, it's all, again, I wrote that, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years ago now. So I kind of did feel bad. I apologized for hurting her feelings, because I'd never want to hurt anybody's feelings. But I still hold that same kind of... Because I run into it too often, and you guys might in your own day to day, sometimes you just sit down at a party maybe with someone you don't know, and they say, oh, what are you into? And you say some of the books and movies that you like, and there's this like, oh, really? Like that? It's tiresome. It's tiresome because it's belittling, and there's that subtle, sly sense of like, well, I'm more educated or I'm more erudite than you are because I read this or I watch this, and I would never stoop to doing that. So so that really gets on my nerves, and I assume it has to get on your nerves too.
I totally relate it.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah, exactly. So I don't really care how she'd react to Nick Cutter. You know what I mean? I don't care if they carry that kind of attitude in at me, or I would assume in with you guys, it doesn't go very far because it's marginalizing. And I read all sorts of stuff, but I'm equally as happy and proud of the stuff that I read. And I respect the authors or the creators who come up with that just as much as I respect someone who does a literary or like a deeply dramatic movie.
Well, I guess that makes me an anomaly because I equally like both.
Yeah, there you go. God name, forbid that you could actually do...
I guess that makes me a non-literary
song. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Come on, Chris.
I should jump on that train. You should get out of here right now. I don't want to read another Nick Cutter book. That's not real writing.
Agreed.
I think you should just throw the deep at him and say, hey, I think there's some literary stuff in here. You might, if you can get past all the grue, you might see that.
Yeah, one or two. Well, that's the thing, too. I think that people get it in their head, and I know Steve with the stuff I wrote under my own name, is that they're so focused on the stuff that they think is gross or goes too far or shows no restraint that they kind of willfully miss the stuff that, that probably would hit their sweet spot if they would allow themselves to read it or kind of react with it. They can't separate the two, but writing an entire book that doesn't hit anybody's triggers or bother somebody in that way seems like, that is one thing I will go my whole life without ever writing a book that way, I'm sure. Like, it'd be like writing oatmeal, like the written equivalent of oatmeal, unflavored oatmeal, and I can't do that.
Oh, what fun is that?
Exactly. One thing, I'm just going to go into your past for a minute here.
Okay.
But there's a couple of things I wanted to ask you about.
Sure.
So, one was when you were promoting The Fighter, you did a few boxing matches.
I did.
And... I'd like you to talk about both of them, but the second one, it sounds like that it was against Jonathan Ames. Is that the Jonathan Ames that created Bored to Death?
That's him. That's the man.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, he was actually dating, at the time he was dating Fiona Apple.
Wow.
It was at this gym in Brooklyn where all like Mike Tyson had trained there and like a very popular, famous earthy gym, and there were like three rings in there, and there were some very serious boxers training in one, and in the other one there were like WWF wrestlers were kind of, not the actual people that we would know, but hopefuls were practicing, pile drivers and off the top rope type stuff.
Sounds like a good gym to me.
Yeah, it was just totally cool. And then the third gym had been reserved for us, and it was, a bunch of literary wackadoos who were there. It was fun. I mean, and Jonathan is a very serious boxer and obviously, really good. I mean, he beat me. But it was closer. The first fight was not good for me. It was good for the other guy. But anyway, it was actually fun. It's weird to say looking back, getting the crap kicked out of yourself a couple times, how you could actually construe that in any way as being an enjoyable endeavor and a way to spend months. But the actual training and the camaraderie that I had with the people that I trained with, and the way that I'm, the Davidson jeans are not necessarily conducive to fitness, but it was fun to see just how far you could push your body and actually round yourself into a form of fitness that I was kind of shocked at, even though it didn't actually make me any better of a boxer. I just don't like punching people in the face. Thankfully, I can get punched in the face a few times without getting knocked out. Yeah. But the actual experience itself, and Jonathan was that was before Bored to Death, but he was already a very popular New York figure and a popular writer. He was a really sweet guy. We went out afterwards and just got hammered.
Right on.
So it was fun.
Now, around that time as well, I know you wrote an article, I believe it appeared in Esquire and The Guardian, about steroid use.
You guys did your homework. Yeah.
Sorry.
No, that's cool.
We do try.
But I thought, just again, coming from a horror perspective, I thought that article was absolutely horrific. And I was just wondering, was that 100% true?
Yeah. I know I had a lot of roid heads actually challenge my veracity of those events. But I first start out in the back of workout magazines and stuff, you can get what would seem like to be steroids, and you send them away like you would for sea monkeys when you were a kid, and they show up and instead of Diana Ball with an O at the end, it's like Diana Bull. And you realize it's sugar water, basically. It's, okay. You're putting it on your tongue. And I remember, okay, I'm going to be a monster now. I go into the gym and I'm like, I'm clearly not making any. So I'd done it with those and I recognized if I'm getting rooked. So I ordered this other stuff through. I actually went in, you had to get like You had to pay for a membership to this secret site where there were like 7 or 8 actual steroid dealers. And then you would, you know, work out a private transaction with them. And so this package arrived from Greece, as I detailed.
Greece, really?
Greece, yeah, that's where it came from. And yeah, it was, you know, foreign stamps all over it. And but it was actually injectable, so it came with the needles and everything. And so, but I'm still thinking, I'm just getting ripped off. This is a next level of getting ripped off, where I have to actually put needles in my ass. But it, you know, I could tell the first time I did. When I was at the gym and suddenly I was like, holy shit, it's like Popeye taking the can of spinach sort of a thing. So yeah, it worked, but it did wreck my body. You know, it wrecked my body in some ways that my main fear was that I was going to wreck my sexual productivity, because it really obviously it shuts off your testosterone for a while. And that thankfully has not proven to be the case. But yeah, everything else was true I would never do it again, but also it did work. You know, I put on about 5 pounds of just pure muscle in two months probably.
Yeah, I think the most horrific part of that article for me was where there was an injection made and then it kept like a bubble inside
you. An abscess.
And
yeah,
you had to take it out with a needle.
Yeah, I just stuck.
Like that was right out of the truth.
Yeah, that was scary too. I mean, you know, that you're putting things into your body that, you know, normally a doctor would or should put into you. And you can't really tell anyone about it because I was embarrassed at some level because I knew it was stupid. So I was living in a foreign country and I had a medical plan through my university, but I couldn't imagine walking into a doctor and just saying I've got this abscess.
Yeah.
And having to deal with all the questions of how you got it and yada yada yada. So thankfully I was able to deal with it myself in a very meatball medic-y kind of a way. Anyways, I was young and dumb, and thankfully I don't have that kind of self-destructive streak in me anymore.
It's pretty incredible. You're like the Robert De Niro of writers.
Yeah. Oh, well.
So you, I also saw an article that you wrote for Maximum Fitness about penis enlargement. Is there any?
Oh man, that one too.
Any,
yeah.
Any truth to that?
We're digging it all out.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
I'm assuming that's not autobiographical.
No, no, that one wasn't. I forget the genesis of that. You know, we had an older editor who was always wanting kind of cutting edge stuff, and this is what. But I remember I had to fight for that article because it was long for that magazine. We usually did like 500, 1,000 word pieces, and that's probably like 3,000 words.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, in a way, it's just as self-destructive to do that to yourself as it is to do steroids, but it's based on that same idea of becoming the Ultraman. You know, and yeah, the Ultraman is packed in muscles, and he's got a, you know, 10-inch penis, and that's kind of what he does. So it was fun to research, and I know back then I was in a cubicle. You know, I was doing a lot of phone interviews, and my fellow cubicle mates would just be like, what the hell is he? Who is he talking to? I hear like laughing over there because we worked at a magazine chain where there was like a cooking magazine and a women's fitness magazine. So it was a lot of women surrounding me too. So I sort of had to warn them beforehand. Like, I'm doing this phone call. You're going to hear some stuff. Please understand,
if you hear me saying, so you guarantee it's going to be 12 yeah, inches when I'm done.
And girthy too, right? Yeah. Yeah.
I want to be a shower, not a grower.
Are you talking about me?
yeah.
Okay, that's enough of the raking you through the coals
stuff. All right.
Why don't we just get back to horror for a bit here,
yeah,
and then we'll wind it up.
Okay.
So I guess, the first question I have was, were you a horror kid? Were you into famous monsters and things like that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I've always been a horror wonk, a horror nerd, a horror whatever you want to call it, a horror obsessive, really. So, books, TV, movies. I remember we used to stay up late to watch a Friday the 13th, the series. I don't know if you ever remember back in the day.
The antique dealers.
Yeah, that's right, the antique dealers. And there was one, I think there was a one where a watch, like a magical watch stop time for 1 minute every day. And, you know, the guy went on like stealing sprees and, you know, took took, you know, vengeance on his enemies kind of a thing. And it was kind of like a modern day Twilight Zone, really. I mean, they called it Friday the 13th, I guess, to kind of draft on the whole movie phenomenon. But it really wasn't like anything like Friday the 13th at all. But yeah, it was because there was something so you stayed up late. You got to kind of be transgressive, you know, and that was all about horror for me. It was staying up late, seeing things that you shouldn't be seeing, reading things. You know, my parents were happy to see me reading books. They didn't really look too much at what I was reading, thank God, because it allowed me to read and kind of get an education that maybe more less permissive parents wouldn't have allowed. So, yeah, absolutely. I've been a horror nerd, and I will be to the day I die. I hope my own son gets into it that way.
So I wanted to quickly I find this interesting when you talk to people who are into horror stuff.
Yeah, sure.
We kind of always have talked about, like, our first horror memory.
Ah.
Like, so for me, it would be like, you know, maybe... For me, it's catching a part of Nightmare on Elm Street on cable TV on one of those free pay TV weekends you used to have as a kid. Or it was like reading books like by Roald Dahl, even like, you know, The Witches and things like that. Yep. Or I'm trying to think who the other guy I've said to you was. Do you remember?
I always think of Jacob Tutu.
Jacob Tutu and the Hooded Fang and things like that.
Yeah.
So we're just wondering, what's the kind of stuff that you latched onto that you were like, okay, so this is my thing. This is my genre. I ride or die kind of thing, right?
Yeah. Oh, that's a great question in terms of like visual movie or say a TV or something, like an illicit peek at something.
Yeah.
But I think for me really it was, you know, this sounds cliche, but for my generation it's probably the gateway for a lot of us. It really was King. You know, it was really, I think my dad bought one of his books and I don't think he even read it. You know, I think he might have started it. Maybe it was Christine.
That's a great one too.
But it just didn't appeal to him. Maybe dad thought it was gonna be like about a hot rodder or something, and it, you know, didn't have enough car stuff for him, maybe. And he just left it kind of just
I thought they'd be racing for pink slips and picking up the girls. What's
that's
this evil
right
car
shit? And duck's ass hairdos and stuff. What's all this? So it it didn't meet his sense of what he wanted in that book, and he just left it carelessly somewhere, and I, you know, bopped across it and picked it up. And as King has this unerring ability, you know, you read one page and it's like fishhooks just jump out of the page and latch onto you. And you're in its thrall. You're not going anywhere. And I remember finishing it. I was sitting on my bed and just, you know, you're trapped in that weird thing of wanting to hurl the book away and clutch it as tight as you can to your chest because it's that push-pull feeling. And there are certainly other things, because I think your horror education has many different layers and tenors, but that would probably be the first kind of instinctive moment that I realized that this was going to be the thing that fascinated me for my life.
I think a good majority of the people in our generation are Stephen King heads, though.
Yeah, I think
I
so, too.
Everyone remembers the first time they read one of his books, and then instinctively, like for myself, I remember, you know, going to the school library and being like, oh, they better have some Stephen King books, and then just getting them all out and hoping that you'd get it done before you had that week to return it and things like that. Like, I remember the first time reading The Stand, his big tome, right? I had to renew that thing like four times. Because when you're a kid, you're like, well, 1,000 pages,
that's
this is crazy, right?
Yeah.
Or 1,200 or whatever it was right?
Enormous, yeah.
So it's just, I think everyone in our generation, that was totally their gateway. But like, was there any like kind of like, you always hear stories about people, you know, oh, I'm watching from behind the couch when my parents are watching like Frankenstein or something like that. Do you have
any
kind of movie moments like that?
Yeah, there was, because our house, we lived in Calgary, and the setup was such that the TV was viewable up the second set of stairs, because the stairs kind of came around. And
oh, the banister watch.
That banister area. Yeah, and me and my brother would crouch my parents would... I remember once my parents rented Last Tango in Paris.
Oh, jeez.
You know,
the
and...
You never looked
the
at butter
scene,
the same
right?
again.
So, you know, and that was one... That's a different kind of thing. It's you're more like your eyes are open to certain things about the human body, I guess, and human sexuality. But we clustered there and watched it. And, you know, once my dad's head would poke around the side, like, and see us up there. I'm like, you little turds, get to bed. And they, you know, they would watch horror movies. And you would, see them from afar. Like, I think maybe Children of the Corn they watched one night. But I remember watching me and my brother clustered at the banister and then not getting scared and not wanting to go back to our rooms, because then you're suddenly like, oh, crap, we've watched this stuff and now we've got to go back to our dark, alone, solitary bedrooms and deal with what we've just seen. But that didn't stop us from, you know, sneaking out to the banister the next time. My parents sent us up and said, you know, we were, you could just tell by the way it sounded. You knew there was something interesting you had to watch.
Of course.
Totally. Like being a kid and going to the old video stores and first time you get the Friday the 13th movie. I have a story about that where I rented the first one with some buddies and ran back four times the same day to get all the sequels.
Nice.
And you're just like, well, I guess this is, I'm in this for life now.
Well, and there was always one permissive parent who didn't care. Like my parents, even if they were about books, they were a little bit lax, but with movies, no way.
Yeah.
But, you know, I had a buddy whose parents couldn't care less. So we would go and there would always be a clerk at the video store who like, didn't give a damn if you were 12 and you were renting R-rated material.
Hellraiser,
especially
okay.
Yeah. And then you'd go and you'd, and you know, often, yeah, you're right. I mean, I had a lot of sleepless nights. I had a lot of nightmares and I had a lot of just sitting in bed shivering going, what have I done? You almost have buyer's remorse of like, why did I do that? But you can't help it because, again, that's, if I hadn't have had those experiences, you guys hadn't had those experiences, we wouldn't be here talking right this now.
Exactly. So, since we're heading into Halloween, I just want to wind down now with, you know, we've established that we're all horror people here.
Sure.
And we're heading into Halloween, so I thought, what's the best thing for a guest to do on a show that's going to air around Halloween, but get some recommendations?
Oh, yeah, okay.
So, you know, why don't we start with books?
Okay.
Like, and so, like I said, The Deep, for me, was my choice of the year. And you had said earlier, Paul Tremblay's Head Full of Ghosts, and I'm fully with you on that. That's a great book as well.
Yeah.
What else do you think people might want to pick up?
Well, if we want to go back a little further.
New or old.
Again, I've mentioned it before, and I'm sure most people, you know, who are listening to this would have heard, or know of House of Leaves.
Yeah.
But again, if we're talking about, let's say, the books that have scared me the most. Let's say top five books that have scared me the most. House of Leaves is there. The Exorcist is there. You know, you could go with a bunch of Stephen King books. I'll maybe do two. It scared me.
I think it scared everybody.
Yeah, it scared me
deeply. We all float down here, Billy.
Yeah. Actually, you know, the one thing, one of the things that scared me the most is a short story, The Bogeyman.
Oh, okay.
Which from Night Shift was a tight, nasty little scary punch in the gut kind of ending story. What you know, I feel like I'm listing stuff that everyone would know about, but you know, just to, you know, to emphasize how you know, like Jaws, you know, Benchley's book, you know, the primordial fear of, there's something great about a writer who can capture something that we're all scared of, but do it in such a way that is again, really conjures it. Because it's easy to write a book about a shark. You think, oh, well, that should naturally just scare people. But it doesn't unless you do it right. If you do it the right way, it really does conjure up that deep dread that, like, I don't want to be in a swimming pool at night because I feel like somehow a shark could be in here, you know?
True.
And I guess a recent one that I really liked, and a lot of people did too, but was Bird Box.
Yeah.
Josh Malerman's book. And then if you're another old one, let's think. Stinger
by
Robert R. McCammon.
Yeah, right. I remember that book cover.
Yeah.
The clawed reptilian hand coming out.
That's right.
Out
it's
of
like
the
an
dirt.
It's his gloss on like an alien invasion kind of a thing, and it's not, you know, he does some really big books and this is kind of a shorter, fleeter, really creepy classic McCammon book.
Yeah, I know that you're a big fan of his.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm just starting to get more familiar with his stuff. Like, I just picked up Boy's Life.
Oh,
and
such a good book.
You know, you find that on everybody's list.
Yeah.
Right? So I'm looking forward to that.
You will. You'll like it.
Yeah. Okay, cool. And so Bird Box was a newer one. Any other new ones you can think of?
Any other new books, recent ones that have come out?
Because I did enjoy Bird Box, but I have to admit that it kind of lost me near the end.
Yeah, okay. Let me think. Well, I mean, maybe we should give some shout-out for some cheesing.
Okay.
Work.
For sure.
I would recommend, we talked about Ian Rogers' work,
yeah, Every House is Haunted.
Great book. That's a great collection of short stories. You haven't read it yet, but it's a little older, but still a goodie, is Michael Rowe's Enter Night.
Right.
Would be another one that I would really recommend. Real Yours, Westlake Soul is great. It's not horror. It's actually really kind of ennobling in some ways. It's fantasy and fantastic. It's not going to scare your pants off, but it'll break your heart a little bit.
Okay, cool. And now let's flip it to the media side of things. So if you were to say, okay, someone's having a Halloween party.
Yeah.
What's the movies they should have on?
Okay, what would I recommend for good Halloween movies? How about you guys list a couple? Let me sort of think now. What would you guys, because you guys... It's part of your podcast, right? Like, what would you say your top three, maybe off the beaten track too?
Off the beaten track. Well, that makes it hard.
Yeah, yeah.
I know Josh doesn't like it, but Michael Dougherty a couple years ago made a movie called Trick or Treat.
I've heard of that one.
It's an anthology, and I really like it.
Yeah, okay.
It follows the mythos of Halloween. It follows the legends of Halloween.
Okay,
really
okay.
good. He's got a new movie coming out called Krampus in December.
I've heard of that one. Yeah, yeah.
That's
okay,
about
okay.
The
whatever legend
Christmas
of...
demon or whatever it is.
Right.
But I really do like Trick or Treat, and I feel like that didn't get the kind of recognition that deserved.
Mm.
But what do you
yeah,
think?
Yeah, and then one I'd recommend, probably from about 8 years ago or so now, is Jeff Lieberman's Satan's a Little Helper.
I haven't seen that one either.
That's a Halloween-based movie, and it's a lot of fun. And there's actually a new anthology movie coming out this Halloween called Tales of Halloween.
Oh, I've heard
of that
one, yeah.
And it's going to have directors like Neil Marshall doing little vignettes. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So I'm looking forward to that one, too.
Neil Marshall's great. Like, I love The Descent.
Yeah, that The Descent's one of my favorite horror movies the last 10 years.
Yeah, yeah, it's brilliant.
And
it's...
I even like Doomsday. I don't care what people say.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I know. Yeah, exactly. I loved what's the werewolf
Mad
one
Max
he did.
With cannibals, come on.
Yeah.
And Dog Soldiers.
Yeah, Dog Soldiers. Yep. That was such a good movie. Yeah, so just like, you know, you know what I liked, and I know, I think it's sort of got, people are getting a little bit into it again, is Halloween 3.
Oh, yeah.
Which is the one with the...
Yeah. Eight more days to Halloween.
That's right. And it's goofy, and whoever the main actor in it is about as wooden as... Yeah, that's right, Tom Atkins. But I don't know, there's something, because it's AMC, you know, has the Halloween countdown every year, and I love going downstairs and, you know, once Nick is in bed and just seeing what they've got, because it's always nostalgic and it's always fun to watch. I mean, I would just recommend people watch what AMC picks, because they seem to get some really interesting old... you know, Halloween-based or horror flicks that I especially hit my nostalgia buttons really heavily. I like Pumpkinhead.
Yeah.
Pumpkinhead with Lance Henriksen. That was a fun, you know, kind of Halloween movie from my childhood.
Putting him on the spot here.
Yeah, exactly.
He's good talk
yeah.
about them
yeah.
books, but
exactly.
I'm
yeah.
still thinking of how Tom Atkins kept getting laid in.
Always getting laid.
He had that porn stash, man.
It's true.
It's
yeah,
that
yeah,
porn
yeah.
stash.
He was just falling into bed with people. You're right. Yeah. Well, everyone was scared. There was the silver shamrock.
Let me comfort you for a minute. I know the lady in the next room just had some bugs explode out of her face, but you know, how about we get down?
Yeah, I don't know, because, you know, there's like, really off-the-beaten-track ones. Like, you guys mentioned Martyrs, but that's not really, that's not Halloween
no,
fare
that's,
to me.
That's more of a, I'm really depressed, let's
yeah,
watch Martyrs.
Yeah, I, exactly. You know, like, I like, you know, I sort of, The Guest, and which was a recent one, and the other one they did...
Your Next.
Yeah, I mean, those are fun, because it's fun.
Yeah.
To me, that's like a fun horror movie. It's not necessarily going to scare you. But it's you know, I think that's, to me, that's Halloween now. You know, it's not, you save things like Martyr or something for a different time of the year.
Exactly.
But Halloween, it's kind of to embrace the, almost the comic fun of
well,
the
that'd
season.
That'd be like me and my Night of the Creeps.
Yeah, you know, I love Night of the
I
Creeps.
I watch Night of the Creeps every
yeah.
year.
Yeah.
Josh is a hater.
Oh, you don't like Night of the Creeps?
I've never really warmed up to it. But now, boy.
Or hey, Slither is another fun
Slither's
one.
Great,
like James
but,
Gunn's.
But come on, man. Night of the Creeps has just Tom Atkins in it again.
Yeah.
He doesn't get laid quite as much, but he's in it.
I was just trying to get lessons from the guy.
We could all take a lesson from Tom Atkins.
Okay, well, I think we've covered the basis, so let's all wrap this bad boy up here. First of all, we obviously want to thank you for coming on.
Well, thank you for your wonderful questions.
It's been a slice, even though we had to start over because I poured water all over my laptop.
It's okay, man. It worked out really
well. That's right. It's all come out in the end.
No, this has been a lot of fun, and we really, really appreciate you taking the time out. And I think our listeners are going to love this. I definitely know we have some people that are fans of yours, so I think just them getting a little more insight. And it's been a really good time. So thank you so much.
Thanks, Josh. Thanks,
and
Chris.
All I got to say is, if you people don't go buy his books, I'm going to hunt you down. Okay, so that's all there is to it. Support Craig Davidson, support Nick Cutter, support Chai Zine, and all those small press. Because without these horror guys, you know, who knows where we're going to be.
That's right.
That's all I got to say.
Appreciate it.
All right. See you later.